Hey, it's Levy, and I want to tell you a little bit about what we're up to in 2014 on the I'll Drink to That podcast show. When I started the podcast over 130-something episodes ago, I decided right away that I wanted to be talking about the wines I believed in. I wanted the wines we discussed here to be the same wines that I would be interested in purchasing myself and working with as a sommelier. With that in mind, the thing that always bothered me the most was when someone told me they couldn't find the wines that we were talking about. And I've gone ahead and tried to change that by partnering with a wonderful shop called Vine Wine, staffed by terrific people, to feature and offer the wines that we discuss here on the podcast to you, our listeners. There are a number of you out there, and we think you may be thirsty. If you like what you hear on the show, simply visit the Vine Wine website at vine-wine.com, again, vine-wine.com, to purchase a bottle, and you can taste what we're talking about. You'll be helping the show, we'll be drinking out loud, and I promise you'll dig it. Again, that website is vine-wine.com. We're going to start up the collaboration with this episode. Cheers.
I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
In today's culinary world, chefs and sommeliers can reach an almost celebrity-like status. To some extent, the world's greatest winemakers experience this too. But historically, and still today, one of the most important parts of the wine business works in the shadows. And some of the most influential palates who guide international tastes are rarely noticed or even recognized. I'm talking about wine merchants, specifically the founders of major import companies who make decisions about what kinds of wines they will import to their markets. We can thank the Phoenicians and Carthaginians for being some of the earliest wine merchants, helping to spread the product around the Mediterranean Sea. But we've come a long way from ships with their hulls stuffed bow to stern with amphoras. Cardboard has even allowed us to use recycled material to ship wine instead of cutting down trees to make boxes. There are many kinds of wine merchants. Today, and I'm sure also throughout history, wine importers sometimes take a passive role, and they simply sell the wines they find as is. These types of merchants sometimes see their jobs as protecting the purity of the winemaker's vision or the traditions of that particular region. But other merchants can help define style, and this can sometimes be very beneficial. They sometimes suggest or ask for certain kinds of wines to be made. Kermit Lynch, for example, famously requested unfiltered wines from many producers, who later stopped filtering altogether. He also helped push for refrigerated containers so wine wouldn't cook en route. An importer may suggest that some of the wine be declassified and aged less to be a glass option, or that some of the wine be shipped in large format. Merchants and importers also make other decisions that can affect what ends up on the wine list. They may make a suggestion as simple as changing the case size. Sommeliers with less space or budget constraints are more likely to buy a 3-pack or a 6-pack of an expensive wine than commit to a 12-pack case. Putting higher-end wines in 3-pack formats influences more people to buy them, and the wine will end up on more wine lists and in more people's glasses. Merchants can mold the wine landscape of an entire market. Colonel Frederick Wildman was instrumental in bringing serious French wines to some of the most famous mid-1900s restaurants in Manhattan, such as Lutèce. Importers like Jenny and Francois or the late Joe Dressner, they helped to drive a new and thriving interest in organic and biodynamic wines in the U.S. Their actions, however indirectly, have even caused a shift in many U.S. winery practices. And newer importers are bringing the far corners of the world together. Gabrielle Simmers sees a bigger market for some of New Zealand's finest wines and is helping to bring them into the U.S. Zev Rovine carries some pretty unique wines from lesser-known countries and regions, too. And there is the side of importing that maybe a lot of us would like to ignore. Huge, gigantic importers that work with million-case production wines. These importers drive global trends by keeping a steady stream of certain wines or grape varieties flowing to inexpensive retail outlets. We might not want to admit it, but these movements affect every sommelier's perspective about what they place on lists. And then there's the internet. Wine merchandising is changing today with the advent of internet sales. Wine shops can sell products remotely through emails and mail or deliver the orders without ever needing a space for a face-to-face interface with the consumer. Who knows? We might even get drone deliveries in the future. Ultimately, a good merchant understands the market that they're selling to. Merchants that choose not to make a difference will pander to fashion, and often with the result of tremendous profits. However, the merchants who truly make a meaningful difference in the world, they tend to be the ones who have a specific future vision for their current wine market, and they bring wines in that only align with their core values. Importing, especially, is a true labor of love. It's an area that's very underappreciated in our industry. We look at bottles and we think, where did this come from? And sometimes we're enthralled by the sommelier who brought it to us. And if we really love the wine, we might check out the winery. We might visit the winemaker, and we might even buy other wines from the region. But when was the last time you drank a wine you really liked and you thought, how did this get from there to my table? It's a question that fascinates me, and I'm so grateful to all the importers and wine merchants who bring us the raw materials to work with in our jobs. Without them, our wine landscape would be barren.
Hey guys, this is Matt Stinton from Hearth Restaurant and Terroir Wine Bar, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about why I love 750. A 750 allows me to search wines, search regions, search price points, and search distributors, all from the luxury of my office at work. It allows me, and this is one of my favorite things, is that it actually allows me to reach out to my salespeople and say, hey, look, this is the wine I'm looking for. Can you bring it to me tomorrow so I can taste it and see if I'd like to buy it? It's been quite successful in that, and I think that it makes the lives of my awesome salespeople a lot easier as well. I also love the feature, and this is a relatively new one, but has been incredibly helpful in my life over the past few months, the idea of allowing our credit information to exist on the site and allowing us to approve who is able to use that and making the process of starting new credit applications with new distributors and new importers so much easier. So for that, I like to thank 750.
Steve Edmonds on the show of the Edmonds St. John Winery in California. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm really glad to be here.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you.
So you were doing some home brewing in the 70s, and you kind of got involved in that world a little bit, and then what happened next?
The woman who I was married to initially back in 1971, when I met her in 1970, she made beer at home. And I kind of just, when we moved in together, I sort of started kind of taking over the home brewing. I can't think of the life of me why, but I did. And, you know, within a couple of years, there was a point at which, it was after she became pregnant with our oldest child. We took this trip around the country to visit old friends on the East Coast and various other parts of the country that either of us had lived in. And it took a couple months, and we spent all the money that we had, and then we got back to California and had to figure out how to make money. And she was a jeweler, and she, you know, was working at that, but her ability to continue that after the pregnancy was obviously going to be a problem. So I actually just went over to the place where I bought supplies to make beer one day, and there was a sign in the window saying help wanted, full-time and part-time. So I talked my way into a job, and they were, you know, happy to know that I knew how to make beer, but they said, you know, you need to learn about wine. And a good friend of mine, somebody that I spent time playing music with, drove a delivery truck for a wine importer in San Francisco, and had tasted a fair amount, knew a fair amount about wine, and really didn't have any friends who cared or, you know, were really all that interested. So when he found out that I had gotten this new job and that, you know, that part of it involved learning about wine, he said, you know, if you like, I'll set up a tasting and, you know, we'll taste through a bunch of different wines, all from the same winery, and I'll teach you what I know. And I said, that sounds great. And I had no expectations at all about what it was going to be like or, you know, I really didn't expect very much. I think my, you know, my sort of frame of reference for any kind of alcoholic beverages in those days was that you merely opened your mouth and poured some in and swallowed. And if it didn't taste really horrible, then maybe you had a little bit more, and you just kind of kept going until you reached a point where you either stopped or did something, you know, that got you in trouble. And here for the first time, you know, I was being asked to smell the wine and swirl it around in the air. And then instead of just pouring it down my throat, actually kind of chewing on it and tasting it. And you know, we have preconceptions about, or at least back in that era, I know I did. And I think the general thought about wine tasting was that there was something a little strange about it. And there was a movie that I had seen, I think really probably before I ever got into the business. It was three Edgar Allan Poe stories, and the movie stars in it were Vincent Price and Peter Lorre. And one of the three stories it was told was kind of a amalgamation of The Cask of Amontillado and The Black Cat. And in it, Vincent Price played this professional wine taster, and Peter Lorre was kind of putting a move on his wife. And so he challenged him to a wine tasting. And it was hysterically funny, but all the things that Vincent Price did were these great exaggerations, almost satirical impression of, you know, of wine tasting. And so that's the kind of thing that people thought wine tasters did in those days, and that, you know, you wouldn't be caught dead ever doing that. And then suddenly I found myself doing it and thinking that it was absolutely essential, and that, you know, it was like becoming a person that I'd never imagined I knew how to be. And it was all because this stuff in the glass suddenly started speaking to me, and I was just transfixed. You know, it was a really big deal.
And what happened for you after that?
This company that I worked for, within a fairly short time, they had a store in Sausalito that was at the north end of the main road that goes through Sausalito, Bridgeway Avenue, and it was in a little kind of a mini sort of a shopping court, and it was set back from the road probably 60 or 70 yards, and it was not well signed, and nobody knew that it was there, and I was made the manager of this store. Nobody ever came in, but they had all these wine books, and I would read all the wine books because that was pretty much all there was to do. But then it became apparent to me very quickly that just two doors up the street was a brand new wine store. So, you know, I put a sign on the door of the place I was working one day saying back in 15 minutes. And I went over and introduced myself to the people over there. And they said, oh, do you want to taste some wine? And because they had samples of things open, or they were just tasting and trying to really just know more about what it was that they were trying to sell people. And so I started going over there pretty much every day, and sometimes I'd put that sign on the door saying back in 15 minutes at about, you know, maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd come back at around 5:30 when it was closing time and just close the store and go home. Within a fairly short time, I started working at that wine store, and only just really a few months after that, the guy who was the wine buyer, who I'd become pretty good friends with, took a job with Sebastiani doing outside sales or something like that. And so I was kind of kicked upstairs in the wine buyer's position. And so, you know, I was tasting stuff all the time and just really kind of soaking it up, you know. And this was 1973 when I was working in the wine store. I started with the other company back in 72. And there was so much good wine available to be drunk or tasted in those days from all of what were thought of at that time as the most important producers in the world, from Bordeaux, Burgundy, Germany, you know, the Rhone, Italy, I mean, you know, just everywhere. And there really wasn't an awful lot of California wine around, and everything was cheap. I could buy at retail 1966 Leva Lascaz for $10 a bottle. And I could buy 1945 Premier Cru Bone from a good négociant for I think $15, you know, in a 29 Pommard Premier Cru from the same négociant for $30. So I got to taste all this good stuff and got the kind of wine education that, you know, if you were to add it up today, it would have been in the tens to maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars for, you know, the value of the wines. So I was lucky. I was really, really lucky. It was, I had done a little bit of visiting wineries up in Napa in those days and had made friends with a guy named Mike Richmond, who at the time was the sales manager for Freemark Abbey, but he was also, he had a hand in the winemaking up there. And he and I struck up a friendship, and I would often just go up there and hang out and taste wine with him and kind of pick his brain. And he would sort of let me in on friends of his who were making wine, doing things that nobody, you know, had heard about yet. And it's sort of how I found out about Chateau Montalina, because he was friends with actually the guy who was the sales manager for Montalina. His name was also Mike, and I, off the top of my head, I can't think of the last name. But he would kind of tell me who to go see, and I, you know, I ended up being a really early supporter of people like Montalina, Stag's Leap, Clos du Val, and Chateau St. Jean, and Lindcrest, and, you know, so forth and so on. Here was this kind of new generation, post Louis Martini and post Inglenook and post BB and so forth, that were trying to make wines in a more direct, sort of more directly European manner than what had evolved in California, which had you know, become in certain ways much more diverse than what's been going on for the last 25 or so years or 30 years, but in a style that was all about making a lot of wine cheap, because that's sort of what people wanted to buy when Louis Martini and those guys, you know, picked up the pieces after Prohibition. And here were suddenly people like Winiarski and Bernard Porte and Gurgitch and so forth trying to get back to, you know, top quality level and, you know, really doing what I felt were really exciting things.
So what did you see as your entry into that world, or was that your world?
Well, no, I was a wine buyer, and I was happy to be a wine buyer at the time. You know, I made wine as a home winemaker, and it was reasonably good, but I didn't imagine that I was doing anything out of the ordinary or particularly interesting or whatever. And you know, there was a reason for that. I was using whatever grapes were available and just glad to get them. And, you know, and I wasn't paying that much attention, you know, as a home winemaker to what I was doing. I knew there were certain things that you had to do in order to have a reasonably successful outcome, which had to do with keeping things really scrupulously clean, you know, minimizing the possibility of microbial contamination and all that kind of stuff. Keeping your barrels full, you know, keeping your carboys full or whatever, and using a little bit of SO2. But, you know, you can make good wine that way, and you can make really mediocre wine that way. And there isn't all that much difference in what you do during, you know, the process to a point. So, yeah, I didn't see myself at that time. I didn't imagine myself as a winemaker. I think it was a really almost insanely impulsive act to start a winery. It's interesting. It there's a little bit about New York in the story. Cornelia and I came back here in the summer of 1984, and I
Cornelia St. John,
my wife and partner. At the time, I was actually working full time for the United States Postal Service. I was a letter carrier. I was a mailman. And I moonlighted in the wine business at that time. I had three or four jobs working for other people buying wine and kind of running the wine department in stores, helped a guy open a store. And I was good at it, and it was recognized that I was good at it to the extent that the owner was willing to give me more and more responsibility. They didn't make it worth my while. They just kept piling the responsibility on. And after a while, I just got kind of burned out and I sort of backed away from the whole thing. And being a mailman had its benefits. I walked 10 miles every day and I got to know everybody, you know, in about a 15 block area. There were parts of it that were really fun. But at a certain point, you know, Cornelius said, you don't want to be a mailman forever, do you? So we were in New York in the summer of 84. And one of the things that was going on in the post office in those days was that if you lived in certain zip codes, the amount of junk mail that you got just became staggering. And the zip code that I was working in was one of those zip codes. And the, you know, what was supposed to be an 8-hour day began to be routinely 10 and a half or 11 hours a day. And, I was making overtime and stuff, but there was a lot of pressure to keep the overtime at a minimum. So there was a lot of pressure to work faster and so forth and so on. And for whatever reason, in August of 84, the load got to such a point where I just felt like, okay, something's got to give here. And so, you know, I thought, well, you know, Cornelia's willing to put a little bit of money into some kind of a venture. And she had money, which I didn't have. And so we talked and I said, you know, I think, you know, maybe we could do some kind of a small scale wine production. And I was making it up as I went along. I mean, I was convinced that it was true on the one hand, but I'd never done it, so I really didn't know what it meant. And God bless her, you know, she said, let's do it, you know. And so we took the plunge at the beginning of 1985. And I had no idea what I was going to make. You know, I had tasted everything, pretty much, except Chocoli. I think there wasn't any around back then. No Petiol Naturel either. And I don't think I'd ever had Pinot Donis. But, you know, pretty much everything else. But I had no idea, you know, what I wanted to make. What I was, one of the sort of motivating factors was the wine business that had been so exciting and fascinating in 1973 had by 1984 turned into this kind of funnel. And if you couldn't fit through the funnel, then you didn't get in. Everybody was, you know, getting rid of stuff that they had made beautifully for years, Riesling and Zinfandel and this and that and the other thing. And everybody wanted to make Cabernet, Chardonnay, not much Pinot Noir. What else is there? Sauvignon Blanc.
Merlot, I guess.
Yeah, there was a little bit, but nobody was ready to say in California at that point, Merlot is a really important grape and we're gonna put it on the map. But it wasn't too long after that seemed to happen. And I just was totally bored with all that stuff. And so I spent about 4 or 5 months just tasting, you know, going out and buying stuff to taste and tasting with friends and just trying to see what kind of resonated, what I kept coming back to, what really moved me. And I was thinking all the while in terms of what can I make that I actually know I can get grapes for. And what it sort of narrowed itself down to was, you know, I knew there was some Syrah. I knew from my contacts, mostly with old wineries that made jug wines, that there was some Grenache and probably some Mourvèdre. And so, you know, that's kind of the direction I was leaning. And in the spring of that year, I had started reading some trade publications, including one that was called Practical Winery, which became Practical Winery and Vineyard and is now part of Wines and Vines. There was an article in one issue about whole cluster fermentation that I thought was pretty interesting. And then there was an article about Syrah, and I thought, you know, I want to know more about that. And then there was a letter from a guy named Robert Mayberry, who actually, as it turns out, wrote a book about the Rhone called The Wines of the Rhone Valley. And it's more like a textbook than a, you know, read for pleasure type book. It's more like a reference book. And Mayberry wrote a letter to Wines and or Practical Winery saying, you know, somebody in California ought to find some old vine Grenache and some old vine Mourvedre, maybe some Carignan, and if there's any Syrah, and do a whole cluster fermented, you know, Cote de Rhone style blend, you know, probably be the perfect thing for California because they've got weather there that's suited to, you know, warmer climate varieties and so forth. So all this stuff's going around in my mind, and you know, and I'm feeling like, okay, I've spent all these months doing this tasting. Now I got to make a decision. And we went to dinner at Chez Panisse one night. I live like 5 minute walk from the restaurant, and we're waiting for a table, and we got a glass of wine at the bar upstairs at the cafe. And I was telling Cornelia all this stuff, and she was saying, well, yeah, it sounds good. That sounds interesting. But, you know, maybe we should think about that. And then we went up, when they called us to our table, we went upstairs and sat down, and they brought the menu and the wine list. And they were pouring, they had a Syrah on the list from Cupé, a 1983 vintage, I think. And I had never heard of Cupé at the time. But I thought, well, this is Chez Panisse, and, you know, they're paying attention to what they're doing, so this might be, you know, something of interest. And they opened it up and poured me some, and I loved it. I thought it was really, really marvelous. And I just said, you know, I feel like I'm getting signals from the universe that this is what I'm supposed to do. So that's where we went, you know, and I started looking for grape sources pretty shortly after that.
You were fermenting in a warehouse space in Berkeley.
Yeah, there was a place that that a guy named Travis Fretter had leased back in maybe 77. And he actually lived in the house next door, and he had a winery called Fretter Wine Cellars there. And he made wine from Cabernet Sauvignon that he and his father planted up on Spring Mountain back in the probably late 60s. And they made a few other wines there as well. And his day job, he worked in wholesale in the Bay Area, and he used to actually call on me in the stores that I worked in. You know, and I had to, of course, think about where I was going to do all this winemaking, and so I called him up, and it just happened that he had decided to shut down his operation, and he was hoping to be able to find somebody to step in and take over the space. So it was really extraordinarily lucky timing. So, you know, I agreed to do that. And then I ended up buying really a lot of his equipment. And Travis had an approach to making wine that was pretty laid back, pretty laissez-faire. I mean, there were certain things that he knew he needed to take care of, and for the most part he did. But he would leave barrels untopped for a fairly long time, and they would develop a certain level of VA that just sort of became part of the style of, you know, what he did. He used really all old barrels, and it was because he couldn't afford to buy newer ones. He used really, really tiny amount of sulfur dioxide, and I don't know that I could say with any accuracy why that was true, but and he kind of guided me through my first year of winemaking in his facility, and I as I watched the wines develop over the course of the first couple of years, it became apparent to me that I needed to make some adjustments to his, you know, approach to doing things, mainly just to be more attentive than he was being. But the fruit he was working with was very forgiving. It was Mountain Cabernet that was very concentrated and really quite wonderful. It was very, very good stuff. So, you know, it would take a certain amount of abuse. And he typically left his wines in barrel for a couple of years before he, you know, got around to putting them in bottle. And part of that was the expense of bottles and of bottling. He, you know, he would have to wait till he had the money saved up and stuff. And he didn't really want to be on extended credit with anybody. He wanted to, you know, pay for everything in the moment, which is a fairly sane approach, I think. But anyway, so that's where I started, and that's kind of that was the starting point in terms of the winemaking instruction that I had, other than, you know, what I knew from that first job that I had. When we started out the first year, I was so lucky to get some of the grapes that I got the first couple of years. The first year we got this extraordinary Morvedra from the Brandlin Ranch on Mount Peter that taught me more about making wine than any other, you know, any other piece of the picture over the last 30 years. It you know, the grapes really had so much character and so much spirit. You know, I felt like I'm just going to keep my barrels full. I'm going to, you know, keep everything clean. I'm going to, you know, because this stuff has a life of its own and it's doing what it wants to do. And we had made a picking decision that year that turned out to have been really, I think, perfect. And it was such a compelling wine that everybody that tasted it just sort of did a double take. Holy smoke, what is this stuff? And I think that certainly over the years, I've you know, I mean, going back to the question I was thinking of that I was asking myself in those first year or two, what is my role here? What is it that I'm doing that makes any difference at all? Because these grapes seem perfectly capable of making great wine all by themselves. I mean, all I'm doing is deciding when to pick them, paying attention, you know, punching them down, figuring out when the fermentation's down to a point where I should press off, you know, which it takes a little bit of learning, but really not that much. So it sort of felt like it became necessary to come up with a narrative in my own mind about what it is that winemakers are there for. you know, of course I'm in a situation where I'm not doing all the hard work out in the vineyard. I'm not the guy who, you know, had to buy the land and clear the land and cultivate the land and, you know, buy the vines and plant the vines and put the deer fence up you know, do this, you know, the spraying for sulfur or do the leaf removal or, you know, any of that stuff. So it's like I'm starting with a really incomplete piece of the picture and trying to fill in all those blanks in my mind. And it's been an ongoing series of revelations, I think, to, you know, to try and understand what it means to be a winemaker in California who doesn't grow his own grapes. And I think the changes that have occurred in my approach have been more just learning that every vintage is really different, trying to understand how you make any sense out of anything, if that's true, because it's almost like you know something, but you know it really only specifically in relation to that vintage, and the next vintage, the rules don't quite fit, they don't quite apply, and you really can't actually do the same thing the same way and expect to have the same result. It's going to be a, you know, whole different ballgame. It's a little bit like contact improvisation or something, you know, it's like, you know, improvisational theater or something like that. It's got a, I mean, actually one of the analogies that comes to mind, being a singer and occasional performer doing the same song two times, I'm not exactly the same person the second time that I sing the song as I am the first time that I sing the song. And I'm not in the same mood, or maybe there's some other direction that my voice wants to go at a particular moment in the song that's different from, you know, what I had done the last time, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's not the kind of thing that you can sort of nail down and say, this is how you do it, you know.
But there is a recording you can drink later, right?
Yeah, it's true. But the problem with that, of course, is that, you know, what you've got will sound different at different points also. And it's like bottle variation with wines, or what might not even be bottle variation, but just, you know, that the wine's a little older than it was the last time you had it, or maybe it's temperature's different, or you're having different food, or, you know, your mood and all that same kind of stuff.
Your wife is now your ex-wife. That right. Kind of mood right. Changes yeah, yeah, on you. Yeah, and you're like, yeah. This wine sucks. Or maybe the opposite.
Right,
maybe you're like,
right.
This is the greatest wine ever.
Right.
You began an engagement with the Durrell Vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen? How did that start?
That's a great question in a way, partly because it illuminates a little bit what it was like to be trying to make wine from Rhone grapes back in the mid-80s. You know, the first year we got Syrah from Estrella River Vineyard in Paso Robles, I knew that Bob Lindquist had made really good Syrah from there. So, you know, my impression was, oh, that'll make really good Syrah. And I figured all I got to do is call them up and tell them when I want them to pick it and everything will be fine. And they completely screwed it up. And the wine was kind of good anyway, but the actual alcohol in the Syrah from that vineyard that year was 10.75. So it was really light and it was a little mystifying. We got Grenache from an old planting on Spring Mountain, the Marston Ranch, that also has Cabernet that was, at least for a while, sort of famous. The Grenache was actually Grenache Gris, and it was made pretty decent wine, but there wasn't very much of it. There was a lot of the Estrella River Syrah, but I, you know, pretty quickly decided I would never use that fruit again. And then there was this little bit of this brilliant Mourvèdre on that Viter. You know, so the amount of wine that I was able to make out of all this stuff was quite small. And I thought, you know, if I'm really going to be able to do something here that involves growing and, you know, and being able to kind of find my way, I need some more fruit sources. And so I set about trying to first find, you know, whether there was more Mourvèdre around, more Grenache and so forth. But second, trying to find people who might be willing to plant grapes for me. And at that time, it seemed for the most part that nobody in either of the main coastal counties, Napa and Sonoma, really had any interest at all in growing anything other than Cabernet and Chardonnay, because that's where the money was, that's where the market was. And I, you know, I would say to them, well, you know, I'll pay you a good price. And they would say, yeah, but what happens if you get run over by a fire truck, you know, and I put all this money into planting these grapes and now I got no place to sell them. But in the course of visiting vineyards and talking to growers, this guy in Alexander Valley who said he was thinking about planting Syrah mentioned that he knew this guy, Steve Hill, who had planted Syrah at the Durrell Vineyard that for a few years was going to Kenwood Winery. And Kenwood was actually, as it turns out, using it in the equivalent of what we used to call Burgundy in California, you know, just red table wine. That included some other things as well. And he said, you know, he said, I guess he had tasted the wine that Kenwood had made from the Syrah. He said it was really good. So I called up Steve Hill, and as it turns out, and I didn't really find it out for a while, but Kenwood had decided, and they had told Steve Hill, if you can find somebody else who wants to buy this fruit, you should go ahead and sell it to him. Because we've decided that, you know, it doesn't work for our program. And so, again, I was really lucky. The timing was perfect. I got a hold of Steve. We hit it off really well. And he was willing to, and, you know, had the fruit to sell me and was willing to sell it to me. And as it turns out, you know, I asked for such a small amount and there was still more of it available. Kendall Jackson swooped in to buy the rest of it. And it turned out it made extraordinarily good wine that also really taught me a lot, you know, in terms of just, you know, finding out when it's presented to me what really great Syrah is like, finding out what really great Mourvèdre is like, and feeling the way I responded to it in a really visceral kind of way. So, yeah, we started working with that fruit in 1986, and the original block of Syrah that they had, which was in the Sonoma Valley appellation, right at the base of the hills on the west side of Sonoma Valley, got phylloxera in the late 80s, but continued to produce really, really good wine for a number of years. When they figured out that they had phylloxera, it was around 1990, they planted some acreage on kind of the other side of that first ridge of hills in an area that had been included in the Carneros AVA, or Sonoma Carneros. And they had some blocks where the soil was pretty much identical to what they had in where the original block was. The original block was on AXR1 rootstock, which is the rootstock that everybody had planted because it worked so well. And unfortunately turned out to have a, vinifera parent and therefore was susceptible to phylloxera. So they planted these other blocks, some on the same kind of rocky clay soil that was in that original block, and then some on some more volcanic kind of red loamy soil. And I was given my choice of which of the blocks that I would take fruit from, and I took the ones on the red rocky volcanic soil, partly because it was up higher up the hill, should drain a little better, a little bit more sun. Kendall Jackson therefore took the stuff on the other soil. Between 1990 and 1996, actually, I guess first grapes from those new blocks were 92. So from 92 to 95, Kendall Jackson tried to make wine on those new blocks and had all these problems that were just completely baffling and confounding. And I tried making wine because they said, no, we don't want them, you know, after 95. So I tried making some wine from them in 96. And it was this weird thing where when the grapes got to a certain point, usually around 20 to 21 bricks, the vines would start to shut down and the pH would just go shooting up and the integrity of the flavors would just come apart and just everything went to hell in a handbasket. So, you know, there was clearly a problem with the rootstock and the site that they had chosen. The ones on the more volcanic soil made somewhat better wine, but nothing in any of the new blocks made wine like the original block did. So there was something about the AXR rootstock in that site with that cyan wood that was, you know, like having the winning lottery ticket. It was the right stuff. And once they took those vines out, gone, never to be seen again.
For a number of years, I've always really admired the Edmund St. John wines. Mm-hmm. I always thought, why is that? You know, why do I really mm-hmm. like this so much more than this other Syrah or this other Grenache-based wine? Or not that there's a lot of other Gamay or Vermentino around, but... And one of the conclusions I kind of provisionally came to was that it seems like you were always picking sites that had strong soil signatures mm-hmm. that weren't normal for California. Mm-hmm. So right. I consider yeah. all granite and limestone mm-hmm. and volcanic soil to have really strong soil signatures
right.
for me that yeah. I can taste. Yeah. Like I can be like, oh, okay. Yeah. And another one is schist, but not that you have that, but
right.
you know,
right.
a dummy.
Wiley was actually more taste. Like schist.
Is that true?
Yeah. And that's actually, the Wiley property was where we originally put Vermentino and Grenache Blanc.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that something that, is this coincidence? Is that something that you look for? Am I wrong? You know, when you think about, because...
Yeah, you're wrong.
But there's not so much granite. There's not so much limestone. There's not so much...
Yeah.
volcanic soil in California, seemingly to me.
Actually, there's really a lot of volcanic
soil. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. The main area where you find limestone is the Central Coast. There's a big piece of it that's ancient Cretaceous era limestone. And there were a few wines that we made down there. I felt like that really came through real strong, particularly with the Mourvedre from Rosette Vineyard, which was kind of the organizing principle for the red wine that I made from the grapes down there. But also, Tablas Creek sold me some Roussan in 2004 that made a really extraordinary wine that has that kind of spine-tingling nervosity that you get from limestone. And it's just, you know, it's palpable. It's really, really fun. Putting Gamay on granite was partly just knowing that Gamay and granite seemed to really like each other in France a lot. And interestingly, Gamay was kicked out of Burgundy because it doesn't generally do very well in limestone. But the other thing that was interesting, we originally put Gamay on, you know, the planting at Witter's Vineyard, the first planting that we did in 2000 was on volcanic clay loam soil, just like the soil at Fenati, but higher elevation. And it gives wine with perfume. That's partly why I was optimistic about how it would do there. But the odd thing was that for the first, I would say, 4 or 5 years, that we made wine from the Gamay at Witters, the red wine seemed to lack much of any tannin. And it was strange, you know, it was sort of like, well, the aromas are there, the acidity's there, the focus of flavors is there, but there's no texture. So it was kind of like, you know, the Mona Lisa without hair or something, you know, it just didn't come across quite right. And in the meantime, we had been looking for a couple of years for a site with granite, and the Barsotti Ranch, which is a place that has historically mainly just grown apples and produced a lot of apple juice, had taken out a bunch of trees and had a bunch of land that they were willing to make available to plant grapes on. So Ron Mansfield, who's the guy I work with up in the foothills, you know, said, "You want to put some out there?" And I said, "Yeah, that looks good." You know, we visited the site, and it's a bit lower than the Witters, but it's still up real high. You know, it's right around 3,000 feet. We put vines in the ground in 2005, got first grapes in 2007, and right out of the chute, the tannin was there, the texture was there, and it was just, it had a much more distinctive, as you say, soil signature and a kind of nerve to it from that, I think, that the Gamay at Witters did not have for red wine, which ultimately kind of led me in the direction that I've taken to just reserve the Gamay at Witters for making rosé and to make all the red wine from the Barsotti fruit.
One of the things I also associate with your wines quite often, I mean, not in the case of lighter Gamay, but is ageability. Mm-hmm. In a time when it seemed like a lot of people in California were going for wine you could drink on release, mm-hmm. you were making wines that really benefited from mm-hmm. a lot of time in the bottle. Mm-hmm. Conscious choice, just what the fruit gave you? How did that come about?
I think really more than anything, it's just the way that my nervous system reacts to my raw materials. You know, it's and I think that kind of goes back to what I was talking about the question, what's my role? You know, I'm the person who has to, the wine has to be made as part of a process of the interaction between the fruit and the winemaker. And so it's not like there's a conscious idea that I've got, I'm going to make the wine taste this way, but it's more like this conversation that I'm having with the fruit, which leads to these wines that are, for the most part, pretty structured. And I think it's that structure initially that makes it possible for the aging to play out the way it does. The other thing I think, and this is something that has evolved over the years, part of this narrative that I keep trying to construct for myself about what I'm doing. I started, this was actually after a tasting I did in Chicago with Robert Mayberry, who'd written a book about the Rhone, who spent a couple of months every year in the Rhone during the summer. He was a instructor at a college in Michigan during the rest of the year. And then in the summer, he'd go live in the Vaucluse. But he invited me and another winemaker to Chicago for a weekend in 1989 to taste through a bunch of multiple vintages of mostly not super well-known, but very, very good Southern Rhone red wines, Grenache, Mourvèdre, Syrah blends. And what I was struck by, there were wines, this was 1989, there were wines going all the way back to the early 70s that were that had such freshness and such liveliness, not primary fruit, it was definitely evolved, but the wine still had so much energy. And interestingly, I mean, discovered after a certain amount of research and asking questions, most of the wines were actually made in concrete and never touched wood. But the other thing is that they were often in the bottle prior to the succeeding harvest. And the kind of ongoing model at that point in California, which still I think for the most part is a model today, is you put your wines in wood and you leave them there for couple of years, you know, or maybe a year and a half, in some cases maybe 2 or 3 years, and they get better, you know, from that. And that suddenly it started to make sense to me that wasn't necessarily the thing that I wanted to be doing, nor what I felt would give me a successful outcome. And I actually made a wine in 1989 that I had already fermented, and we were using old puncheons at the time, so it was in wood, but it was in these larger, you know, like 20-year-old puncheons, but it was still real primary and pretty fresh. And when I came back from Chicago, I started recognizing things in the wines that I was had been tasting in these wines from the Rhone at the tasting in Chicago, and kind of putting things together in my head in a different way, and decided to start bottling in the, you know, in the early summer following the vintage, get the wines into bottle real fresh and let them do most of the aging in the bottle. And I think that has a huge part to play in that whole thing of, you know, how do the wines age? I think that freshness is a critical issue in California. I don't think you can really make fresh wines in the way that most California wine is being made. You know, I think the wines have to be picked with lower pH. And, you know, there are, I think, ways to farm that will make it possible to get ripeness, good flavor development, good phenolic maturity at lower pHs and certainly lower Brix levels that would make it possible to, you know, really boost the freshness level in California wine a lot. So decisions are being made either to do that or not to do it, but that's the direction that I've, you know, certainly found myself taking.
What vineyards have been particularly engaging to you? And I ask because it's not always the wines that you're making currently, I feel, because you've lost some sources, gained others. Yeah. Sometimes it just hasn't worked out with the person who controlled the site, or phylloxera comes in.
Right.
But looking back, what were the sites that really you learned from, you were impressed by, that lent something to you?
They're pretty easy to pick out, and they're pretty numerous. And it's true that there are a lot of them I don't work with anymore for all kinds of reasons, strange and normal. Certainly the Brandlin Vineyard. You know, they're not just the vineyard, but also the two brothers who farmed it, who were extraordinary guys and great teachers, you know, people who I felt a very deep connection with, just partly for having spent time in their presence. And, you know, there's a handful of people that I have that same feeling about. Marc Olivier, Domaine Pepierre, and, you know, a few people like that. But the way that they took care of their vineyard was kind of timeless. You know, it felt like it could have been, you know, the 19th century or the 16th century or something. You know, it's just such a natural kind of in syncness with the environment and, you know, the elements and so forth. And the life in the fruit was completely inspiring, you know, just really, really great. They had a kind of decomposed sandstone and shale kind of ground that the vines were in that the Mourvedre seemed really, really happy with. You know, there was Zinfandel grown there as well that was very, very good quality. There was also a small amount of old Carignan there that was absolutely unlike any Carignan that I've ever tasted from anywhere. The fruit was just stunningly pretty and had a really nice role to play in the wine that I put together using that in the Mourvedre from there. And there was some old Charbonneau there that was quite remarkable as well. But of the four red varieties, really the one that made the best wine was the Mourvedre. And that is not taking anything away from the other ones. But this was a vineyard that produced fruit that could make wine that would stand up proudly next to any red wine made anywhere by anybody. It was very, very special stuff. And I think that original planting at Durell was extraordinary. It was really, really amazing. You know, I think I told you this story about the Mourvedre at Rosette Vineyard the first year that we got that. I felt like I was being communicated to directly, visually, by the grapes that year. That, you know, there was something going on in the ground there that was, you know, could have been a really great planting of Mourvedre. And maybe it still will be. I don't know. They had these really horrible problems with rodents, you know, ground squirrels and gophers and stuff. And the vines suffered greatly as a result. And I don't know whether they've gotten that all squared away or not. But the first couple of years, the Mourvedre that came out of there was very, very good. Really, really good. And I mean, it was kind of amazing. Mourvedre has a reputation in France as young vine wine of really not being suitable for carrying the name of the appellation. In Bandol, you can't use wine from vines that are less than, I think, 8 or 9 or 10 years old in a wine that you use the appellation Bandol with. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be vines of at least a certain age. But that, you know, the wine we were able to make with that, you know, first crop Mourvèdre from Rosette, some of the best wine I ever made. Really, really good. Certainly Barsotti and Fanati. And I think Wiley was a really great site. I only made one vintage of pure Wiley Syrah of 2009, and it's a little on the monolithic side. It's going to take 30 or 40 years to really come around. Bassetti was also, I think, really quite a great site, but very challenging. It was cold site, and there was one year when the fruit really, really didn't get ripe, which is kind of stunning for California because such a long growing season. But I don't know what explains it, but all the leaves were gone off the vines by probably mid-October in 2002. And usually, you know, at that point, your vine is going to want to shut down. These grapes hung out there for another month and never really advanced beyond about 19 degrees sugar, and actually made wine with some real character and some real flavor, but screechingly high acidity and amazingly low pH. I mean, usually when the vines shut down, the pH goes way up. This didn't happen out there. But Bassetti, you know, it was a place where the vines really had to struggle, and they were stressed by the cold and stuff. The concentration, the sort of depth, and the aromatic nuance in the wines, I think, was pretty special. You know, I made Zinfandel from a whole bunch of different sources, and in virtually every case, I think every single case, something happened that made it impossible to continue working with those grapes. And after a while, I just started thinking, I'm not supposed to make Zinfandel. So I stopped. But we made some Zinfandel from a vineyard up in Amador County and in Shenandoah Valley for a couple of years that was really, really quite good. You know, back in the late 60s and early 70s at Deaver Vineyard, there was Zinfandel that I got a chance to taste in the 70s that I thought was amazing. It was a great argument for a great terroir in California, Zinfandel in decomposed granite in Shenandoah Valley and also in Fiddletown. Just, you know, very distinctive, very unique, and, you know, maybe an example of what Zinfandel is supposed to be, you know, or at its very best. Like Barolo is an example of Nebbiolo in the right place, you know, in the hands of the right winemakers. And I was inspired to try to make wine like that, you know, thinking, boy, I'd love to make something that tastes like that. And I felt like I really had a couple of years where I was able to do that. And interestingly, and I was really excited about it. And, you know, for a number of years, I sent Robert Parker samples of wines that I made. And he said some very nice things about them numerous occasions. But he didn't like those Zinfandels at all. And he gave me really, really bad scores. I was actually kind of stunned. And I started kind of unconsciously thinking, okay, so maybe those weren't such good wines or something. And you know, even though, you know, on the other hand, I really knew that they were really good. And I kind of forgot about them for a long time. And then, I don't know, 7 or 8 months ago, I opened up a bottle of one of those Zinfandels, and I was having pizza and I was watching a baseball game, and I wasn't thinking that much about the wine. I just said, I want some Zinfandel. And I thought, well, that's a 94, but that's okay. I'll, you know, it's probably still okay, you know, but I really wasn't expecting very much. And it blew my mind. It was wonderful. It was really good. And I kind of thought, holy smoke, you know, what have we come to when you can have something that's clearly really, really good and somebody in a position to say, oh, don't buy this stuff, says that, you know, something wrong. Anyway.
One of the things that tends to come up when you tell stories about wines that you've liked that aren't your own is that they're often really good European examples.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people it seems like you often drink with is Kermit Lynch. Mm-hmm. I often see his name come up.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been a back and forth there? Has he opened up bottles from his portfolio or said, hey, Steve, what about that? Or no?
We, for quite a number of years, would get together for lunch, usually once a year at Chez Panisse, and each of us would bring some wine. And I'd bring, you know, often things that I had made, and he would bring stuff from his cellar that he had imported. And it was it was pretty fun. One year, one of the Zinfandels that I did make, which was from the Brandlin Vineyard, the 1990 vintage, struck me very early on, and it went, you know, it stayed that way really right through bottling and through the aging of the wine, as reminding me in an uncanny way of the Gigondas wines from Domaine du Caron from back in the late 80s and early 90s, which I thought were marvelous, marvelous wines. And so one year when we were going to have lunch, I asked Kermit to bring a bottle of the 89 Caron Gigondas, and I brought the 90 Zinfandel, and I walked in and I put it down on the table, and he said, what the hell is that? Why, you know, he said, I thought we were going to drink something that was like similar. And I said, well, just wait, you know, just taste the wines. And so we opened them both up, and he tasted one, then he tasted the other, and he kind of looked up and he went, these are both really good. It was always really great fun to share wine with him, because he always had something wonderful to drink. And it was also really pleasing to know that he really liked the wines that we were making, and, you know, felt like there wasn't such a huge gap between the wines that he was selling and the kind of wine that I was making. So,
were there other positive reinforcements around, or was it somewhat lonely in the 90s? Well, I mean, Parker gave you some good scores in the 90s. Yeah, so maybe it was more the 2000 era that was a little bit,
not the
most rah-rah Steve era.
Right, yeah. I mean, people like David Bowler and, you know, a lot of the people that I work with at the level of sales with the wines have given me tremendous amount of encouragement. And, you know, a lot of my friends who are winemakers really have also done that. Bob Lindquist has been a great supporter, and lots of winemakers from France, you know, who tasted the wines and really liked them. There were a series of classes at UC Davis for, you know, people who are winemakers about working with Rhone grapes, and they would get various wine producers to speak. And one year, and I think it was probably in 96 actually, or it may have been 95, Alain Griot was there, and also Alain Dugas from Chateau Linherbe, who apparently no longer owns that, but he did for a while. But they were both there, and there was a tradition to have dinner on Friday night at this little French restaurant in Davis the night before the class. And we were at dinner, and Griot was sitting across from me, and I had admired his wines for a very, very long time, and I never had the chance to meet him. And was intending to say something along those lines, and he beat me to it. You know, he said, you know, we'd never met, but I have your wines in my cellar, and I really think they're wonderful. And I said, she took the words right out of my mouth. And then I got to visit him in 96 in Gros Hermitage and taste through his wines in barrel. And he had said something about something in the character of the Syrah from Durell struck him as familiar, something that he recognized in his own wine and vice versa. And tasting at his cellar, I had exactly the same experience. So, you know, there's just some shared sensibility, some way of relating to the wines. It was pretty similar. I mean, the best thing was when François Perrault from Tompier came to the winery back in 87, and that Mourvèdre from Brandlin from 86 was in barrel, and we were tasting in the cellar. Kermit and François came, and we tasted through everything that I had made from 86, and he was very circumspect through the whole tasting. There's no reaction at all, and I was kind of dying, you know. oh, I really want him to like my wines. And then we got to the Mourvèdre, and suddenly, you know, he had the wine under his nose and he took a sniff and he just kind of stopped and closed his eyes for a minute and breathed in and out. And then he let out this sigh and his eyes rolled up and he said, La terre parle. And everybody just kind of went, yeah, yeah, this is really good. So, you know, that kind of thing really fed me. It made me, you know, kind of feel like, you know, I knew when I was working with the fruit that there was something great there. And it was sufficient to kind of sustain me most of the time, but it was always great to feel the, you know, the affirmation from the other, you know, winemakers around to say, that's really, really neat stuff. That's exciting. You know, it's really fun. It's everybody needs that. You know.
Are there other stories in California that haven't been pursued in terms of a grape variety in a place that you think would be interesting?
Actually, I think Timorosa would be really fun in Paso Robles, you know, or maybe somewhere a little cooler in the valley or someplace in Santa Barbara, Los Alamos maybe, or someplace like that. I had a lot of fantasies about, you know, where to put certain grape varieties. You know, I love it when I taste something that I've never tasted before that I didn't even know existed that completely rocks me. And Timorosa was like that the first time. It's like, wow, where has this grape been hiding? There used to be a fair amount of Melon de Bourgogne in California, which was, for the very longest time, misidentified as Pinot Blanc. And I don't think that anybody ever really tried to make a Muscadet type wine from it, but and it was not necessarily planted in a place that made sense for that variety. Although Chalon had some planted up at the Pinnacles that made very good wine, but it was made in such a different style, you know, much more attempting to be a white Burgundy rather than a really fresh, you know, briny kind of a wine. So that's one of the fantasies, you know, find a place that's cold enough and close enough to the ocean and see if you can eke out a little Muscadet. I, you know, I had fantasies about Pulsard. And actually, I used to, you know, I used to really, really love Friuli and white wine. And would think about, you know, Pinot Grigio, and I made Pinot Grigio for a while, and then started calling it Pinot Gris because it tasted more like Pinot Gris. Thought about Tokaj Friulano, didn't really know that a lot of the grapes that were identified in California as Sauvignon Vert were in fact Tokaj Friulano, and one of the places where that grape was growing that I wish that I had known about that misidentification was Brandlin. There was some of that variety up there for, you know, the first 6 or 7 or 8 years that I worked with grapes up there. And that could have been really fun. And I had fantasies of smuggling Ribolla Gialla into the country, but somebody beat me to it. Pulsard is coming, not necessarily for me, but it's coming.
Something that you've worked with for a few years and seemingly found more and more success with each year is Gamay, mm-hmm. and also Vermentino. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your engagement with those two very different grape varieties.
Yeah, Gamay goes way back to the beginning of my time in the wine business when I was a wine buyer and would do a lot of tasting, partly just because I was being offered wines to sell all the time. And in fact, the company that my friend who drove the delivery truck for worked with a negociant company called Bonsall Segerman that used to bring in a Cru Beaujolais from each of the different communes. And they were often very, very good and very heady and fresh and absolutely ravishing, beautiful fruit, and so pleasurable to smell and to taste that if I didn't have a lot of friends helping me drink the bottle, I would, you know, just guzzle the whole thing and feel totally glad through the whole experience. And then, you know, the next morning wish I'd been a little bit more circumspect about it. So Gamay was something that I, you know, I truly loved. And you know, the idea of getting to somebody to actually plant Gamay in California seemed like a very unlikely proposition. But my relationship with Ron Mansfield, who I, you know, work with in the foothills, was such, as it evolved over the years, that he would very often come to me to talk about a farmer who had been growing pears or apples or, you know, peaches or something, and had decided they, you know, they were not making any money doing that, and they wanted to grow wine grapes, and would I come look at this spot and see what I help him figure out what to plant there, you know, what would make sense. And in 1999, Ron asked me if we could drive down to Paso Robles together, because he'd been hearing about all kinds of good stuff going on down there, and he wanted to see what was going on. So I made a bunch of appointments, and we went down to visit people down Paso Robles and Santa Barbara. And on the way down there, he was telling me about this guy who had Bartlett pears at this really high elevation site in El Dorado, who had decided that he wanted to take out pears and put in wine grapes. And he described the site. He said it's at 3,400 feet. It's on a north-facing slope. It's got volcanic clay loam soil, just like the soil at Finotti. And, you know, it seemed like it'd be a very, very cool kind of site. And did I have any ideas about what kind of grape to plant there? And before I could actually even venture a suggestion, he said, how do you think Pinot Gris would be there? And I said, you know, actually, it sounds like a really good site for it. I said, but, you know, what I would really love to see in a spot like that would be Gamay. And my mind was racing, you know, I was thinking, I'm going to trick this guy into planting Gamay for me. And he immediately said, well, isn't that what Ken Johnson had planted over where you had him grafted over to Pinot Gris? And I said, well, you know, it used to be this, the grape that Ken had used to be called Napa Gamay, but it's really Valdier, and it ripens at the wrong end of the season. He could never get his Valdigier above 20 degrees Brix, because it's just too late of a grape. And it, you know, there wasn't enough sustained heat to really get it ripe. But if you put Gamay, you know, in a spot like that, or better yet, you know, up where Witters is, it ripens right at the beginning of the season. It makes a wine that everybody's going to want to drink within a year or so. So it, you know, it'll, you know, it's not something that you're going to have any trouble selling, as long as they're not, you know, completely devoted to Petite Sirah or something like that. You know, I think if somebody planted a little bit of Gamay up there and, you know, could make a few hundred cases of wine, could sell that, wouldn't be a problem. And he was intrigued, and we drove back from Paso that evening, and he spent the night at my house, and we had dinner, and I opened up some bottles, and he flipped. You know, he said, man, these are really, really good. They're really fun to drink. And I said, yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of the whole idea. So he went back to Bob Witters and said, this is what I think we should do. And he suggested they plant, it was 3 acres of Pinot Gris and 4 acres of Gamay. And Bob said, sounds good to me. And, you know, I felt like the cat that swallowed the canary. You know, it's just like, wow, that was way too easy. Ron said, afterwards, he said, now you're going to buy these grapes, right? And you promised to buy them for, you know, the first half dozen years. I said, don't worry about it. I'll do it. But then I, you know, I talked to my friends, you know, other friends in the business, some of the people like the guys that hang out on Wine Disorder. And at least one person said to me, you've really lost your mind. But, you know, we've managed to somehow convince enough people that we've been able to sell all the wine. And interestingly, you know, it's been 12 vintages of Gamay at Witters and 7 at Barsotti. And now there's a clamoring for Gamay at the level of, you know, not just restaurants and retail stores, but wine producers. You know, some of them are lining up to get the second crop from the Gamay, and some of them are talking to Ron about planting it for him and stuff like that. So it's really interesting how things are kind of turning with that. Vermentino, when I visited Domaine Tempier on my honeymoon in 1986 at dinner, the night we were there, they actually had us overnight. They found out it was our honeymoon, and they decided that they would be our hotel. I was asking, you know, if you guys don't make any white wine, but if you did, what would the grape be? And Francois said, you know, it's not permitted in the Appellation, but the Rolle grape would do really well in our terroir. And he said it's called Vermentino in Italy and some other parts of the world. And so I was very intrigued. And he said, you know, they make wine from it in Belley near Nice. And it was very hard to find any wine from Belley anywhere. and any that had enough of a percentage of Vermentino in it that I felt confident that I could get some idea what it tasted like. So I kind of forgot about it for a while. And then just a few years later, we were in France again, and then Italy in Liguria. And we were actually, we spent a few days in Cinque Terre hiking around and stuff. But there was the place we were staying, there was a little trattoria behind the B&B, and they were serving this wonderful local pasta dish called panzotti with walnut sauce. And there was Vermentino to drink. And I said, oh, you're finally going to get to taste it. And, you know, so we drank some. And I immediately felt like, why don't we have this grape in California that would be so good? It's so much more expressive than Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc. And it's more fun and lively, you know. But I mean, it's not about being important, you know. Chardonnay wants to be important, or at least has wanted to be important. Sauvignon Blanc somewhat less so. But Vermentino is just a pleasure to drink and you know, really wonderful at the table, really versatile and enjoyable. On that same trip that we had gone to Cinque Terre, just a few days before that, we'd been at Bocastel on the day that they shipped their plant material to the United States for the Tablas Creek project. And I had no idea, but they had actually included in the plant material Vermentino for Tablas Creek. So several years later, I discovered that there was, in fact, now Vermentino in California. And then I just had to find somebody to grow it for me. And the Wiley property where we initially put it, it's a very, very rocky schistous kind of ground up there, especially on the northeast side where ultimately we ended up planting those vines. It's really, really interesting soil, and it's a fairly warm spot, but there's a tremendous amount of westerly wind in the afternoons there during the summer, even when it's like 95 or above at, you know, maybe 2 or 3 in the afternoon. During the later hours of the afternoon and early evening, the winds really come up and it cools down quite a lot. And so there's some real moderating influence, and it's cold up there at night, mainly from mountain air coming down from, you know, the high Sierras. We discovered the first year that we had grapes that, the two grapes, Vermentino and Grenache Blanc, ripen at the same time. I guess we haven't talked about Grenache Blanc, but that's part of what we also planted at that vineyard. And that the grapes have a tremendous amount of flavor at just a little over 20 degrees Brix. So that if we pick somewhere between 20 and a half and 22, we've got really nice ripe fruit, really good acidity, really good low pH, usually 3.3 or below. So something with some real backbone to it, but also a tremendous amount of really expressive fruit and spice and just all the stuff that makes the wine fun to drink. The Grenache Blanc was sort of a just this thing that kind of developed. Ron called me when they were going to put the vines in the ground on the day that they were going to plant them, and said that he had some Grenache Blanc vines because he had ordered too many for another vineyard, and wondered whether it would be a good idea to put some where we were putting the Vermentino. And I didn't hesitate. It was sort of like one of those things, like, what do you think about Grenache Blanc? Oh, I like Grenache Blanc. Without thinking, what am I actually going to do with this stuff when I get it? And then come to discover, when it got to be close to harvest that first year, when there was fruit on the vines, that not only was there a little bit, but in fact, there was almost as much Grenache Blanc as there was Vermentino. But they were ripe at the same time. We had too little fruit to actually press them separately because we wouldn't have had enough to actually operate the press. So we were in a position where we pretty much had to just throw them together into the press anyway. And given the fact that they were both ripe, grown on the same ground, farmed by the same hand, why not? You know, and the result was sufficiently pleasing that we have done it every year since then. It's really worked out nicely.
Steve Edmonds of Edmonds St. John Winery in California, like the mailman, as a winemaker, he's always delivered. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Levy, and I want to tell you a little bit about what we're up to in 2014 on the I'll Drink to That podcast show. When I started the podcast over 130-something episodes ago, I decided right away that I wanted to be talking about the wines I believed in. I wanted the wines we discussed here to be the same wines that I would be interested in purchasing myself and working with as a sommelier. With that in mind, the thing that always bothered me the most was when someone told me they couldn't find the wines that we were talking about. And I've gone ahead and tried to change that by partnering with a wonderful shop called Vine Wine, staffed by terrific people, to feature and offer the wines that we discuss here on the podcast to you, our listeners. There are a number of you out there, and we think you may be thirsty. If you like what you hear on the show, simply visit the Vine Wine website at vine-wine.com, again, vine-wine.com, to purchase a bottle, and you can taste what we're talking about. You'll be helping the show, we'll be drinking out loud, and I promise you'll dig it. Again, that website is vine-wine.com. We're going to start up the collaboration with this episode. Cheers.
Hey guys, this is Matt Stinton from Hearth Restaurant and Terroir Wine Bar, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about why I love 750. A 750 allows me to search wines, search regions, search price points, and search distributors, all from the luxury of my office at work. It allows me, and this is one of my favorite things, is that it actually allows me to reach out to my salespeople and say, hey, look, this is the wine I'm looking for. Can you bring it to me tomorrow so I can taste it and see if I'd like to buy it? It's been quite successful in that, and I think that it makes the lives of my awesome salespeople a lot easier as well. I also love the feature, and this is a relatively new one, but has been incredibly helpful in my life over the past few months, the idea of allowing our credit information to exist on the site and allowing us to approve who is able to use that and making the process of starting new credit applications with new distributors and new importers so much easier. So for that, I like to thank 750.
And that's our episode of I'll Drink to That. We release a new show each Tuesday and every other Friday. You can find the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or stream it off our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you hear, leave us a comment or shoot us a tweet.